The headlines this hour. Lebanese gather near the Beirut port to mark the first anniversary of a massive blast that had claimed over 200 lives and devastated the city. The Israeli military says it has launched artillery attack on southern Lebanon after several rockets were fired toward Israel. Also coming up, a roadside bomb explosion hits a convoy carrying logistics for the U.S.-led coalition in southern Iraq. Thanks for joining us. Thousands of Lebanese have gathered in the capital, Beirut, to mark the first anniversary of a catastrophic explosion that ravaged the city back in 2020. People gathered in central Beirut and then marched toward the city's port. They also demanded justice for the deadly explosion that killed over 200 people and wounded thousands more. The blast, which was occurred last August, caused by the ignition of tons of highly explosive ammonium nitrate stored in the port's warehouse since 2014. Several neighborhoods were also flattened. The then Lebanese Prime Minister Hassan Diab resigned in the wake of the incidents, and since then, the Mediterranean country has been run by a caretaker administration. The Israeli military says it has shelled areas inside of Lebanon thrice in response to an alleged rocket attack. Israeli media reports say that the military shelled Lebanon three times in the span of 2 hours. That after three rockets were reportedly fired from Lebanese soil and landed into northern Israel on Wednesday, prompting sirens. The regime's military has blamed armed Palestinian groups inside Lebanon for the rocket fire, but no group has yet claimed responsibility. There has also been no reports of any casualties and damage over the past years. The Israeli military has repeatedly shelled areas within Lebanon and violated the country's airspace, prompting fierce criticism from Beirut. Israeli forces have demolished several shops belonging to Palestinians in the occupied Al-Quds. Israeli forces, accompanied by bulldozers, razed to the ground about 20 shops in Hizma, northeast of Al-Quds. This is the latest in a series of demolitions carried out by Israel against Palestinian homes and facilities in the occupied territories. Israel claims that the structures lack construction permits. This is while such documents are nearly impossible to obtain. Palestinians say the demolitions are part of Israeli efforts to expand its settlements that are illegal under international law. Palestinians have attended the funeral procession of a young man who was killed by Israeli gunfire in the occupied West Bank last month. The funeral procession was held after Israel handed over the body of 21-year-old Mohammed Farid Hassan. He was killed by Israeli soldiers in a village near the city of Nablus on July the 3rd. Palestinian media say that he was among those fending off an attack by Israeli settlers in the village. The Palestinian Foreign Ministry had described his killing as a crime and demanded an international investigation into his death. Palestinian children in the Gaza Strip are not able to continue their education due to the latest Israeli war on the besieged enclave. Now, the aggression has left at least 260 Palestinians dead, among them 66 children. Until today, many of them are still suffering from nightmares. Ruba Shebit has more from Gaza.
Following the latest Israeli escalation over the Gaza Strip that left more than 200 people dead, including women and children, Palestinians in the Gaza Strip are still recovering the psychological consequences of the war. Almost 600,000 students have suffered a significant learning loss. In conjunction with the announcement of the Palestinian high school Tawjihi scores, 18 students from Gaza are not around to receive their scores as they were killed by the Israeli airstrikes. Khalid Al-Qanoua, a Palestinian student who was supposed to be receiving his high school scores this year, was killed by the Israeli airstrikes, leaving his family grieving.
I remembered Khaled today when I saw other students. Khaled was supposed to be with us today, celebrating his success and distributing sweets like other people. I saw Khaled's mates when they were having their exams, and I felt happy that Palestinians still insist on living their life even after wars and losses. I wish Khaled was here, but I believe that by knowledge, Palestinians will take revenge for Khaled, and his death won't go in vain.
The release of the test scores is usually met with parties, fireworks, and gifts. But due to the crisis in Gaza, many Palestinian students are not celebrating their success.
I have 3 of my sons who finished high school, and we celebrated with them. There were always atmospheres of happiness when my son succeeded. I wish Khaled was here so we could celebrate with him. He would have been something important. This time, the Israeli occupation stole my happiness. I feel his loss in all ceremonies. Whatever the Israeli regime does with its crimes and killings, we will remain patient and we won't give up this land.
Subhi Abulauf, who has lost most of his family members in the Israeli airstrikes, is also among the students who were deprived from pursuing high school, as he is traumatized by his loss.
هذه بصراحة لحظات صعبة بالنسبة لي كتير.
Those are really hard times for me while students are happy for their success, being around their families. I've lost my mom, my sister, and my home, and I couldn't continue going to school. There is no place for happiness. My cousin and I were supposed to be celebrating like our mates, but Tawfiq and my family are not around, and I'm not capable of continuing my education.
Many Palestinian students in the Gaza Strip who have lost their homes and family members are not able to carry on with their test for the time being due to the state of depression and instability they are in following the war over Gaza. Roba Shavit, Gaza.
The British Muslim NGO has begun a legal challenge against the Conservative government over a controversial letter sent to UK schools warning teachers against pro-Palestine activity from students. This pending legal battle could decide the fate of Palestine solidarity activities in Britain at a time when simply wearing a Palestinian flag could see you expelled from school or branded a racist. Rob Carter has more.
British Muslim advocacy group CAGE is preparing to go to war with the British government after announcing a legal bid against Education Minister Gavin Williamson over what they call discriminatory guidance to school leaders on Palestine. CAGE say the letter issued by Williamson on May the 28th amounted to a disgraceful censorship of political dissent in schools and discriminated against students by infringing their rights to freedom of expression.
CAGE has seen nearly 50 cases of people, of students, who've been targeted in their schools for speaking openly about Palestine and defending the rights of the Palestinian people to defend themselves against a system of apartheid and oppression and occupation.
The government's crackdown on Palestine solidarity in UK schools occurred during the huge global outrage over Israel's relentless attacks against worshippers at the Al-Aqsa Mosque and civilians in Gaza last May. Williamson's letter warned teachers to remain impartial on the conflict, but also warned of concerning rise in anti-Semitic incidents. However, CAGE believe this is censorship cloaked by bogus accusations of anti-Semitism.
It is definitely becoming more the case that speaking on the issue of Palestine, advocating for the rights of the Palestinian people, exposing the crimes of the Israeli apartheid regime, these are becoming increasingly issues which are criminalized, issues which are securitized, dealt with very punitive measures, whether in schools, whether in the public spaces, or the debate about it is completely hounded out of the public space, such that these issues are silenced and they are unheard.
Cage are confident of success, as they believe that the government's position on this topic won't hold water if confronted in the courts. And many people are hoping for success here, as the way things are going now, many critics claim and fear that it could become essentially illegal to support the Palestinian cause publicly in the not-too-distant future, unless court battles like this are won now. Robert Carter, London.
Iraqi security sources say that a roadside explosion has hit a convoy carrying logistics for the U.S.-led coalition in a southern province. There were no immediate reports of damage or casualties. No group has claimed responsibility for the attack that happened in Deraa province. Last week, two other logistics convoys for the coalition were targeted in separate attacks in Deraa and Qadisiya provinces. Convoys for U.S.-led forces and American diplomatic compounds have come under repeated attacks in the past months amid rising anti-U.S. sentiments in the Arab country. The Afghan capital Kabul has been rocked by yet another explosion ripping through an area close to the country's main security agency. The blast near the National Directorate of Security left two civilians and a security official injured. It came hours after a string of deadly bomb and gun attacks close to Kabul's diplomatic district. According to an Interior Ministry spokesperson, eight civilians were killed and at least 20 others were wounded during the assaults late on Tuesday. The Interior Ministry later confirmed the killing of all assailants. Afghanistan's defense minister said the coordinated attacks were aimed at him. The Taliban claimed responsibility for Tuesday's attacks and vowed more assaults against top government officials. The UK Maritime Trade Operations say that a potential hijack of a Panama-flagged vessel off the coast of the UAE has ended. The security agency said the ship is safe and boarders have left the tanker. It did not give any details in its warning notice. On Tuesday, maritime sources said the Asphalt Princess tanker had been seized off the coast of the United Arab Emirates. They accused Iran of being behind the incident. A spokesman for the Iranian military dismissed the anti-Tehran allegations. Brigadier General Abulfaz Shekarchi said that Israel and its allies from the region and beyond are waging a media war against Iran, using psychological warfare and creating pretext for adventurism. Said Ibrahim Raisi has been inaugurated as the new president of Iran. He has replaced Hassan Rouhani, whose landmark achievement was the 2015 Iran nuclear deal between Iran and the six world powers. President Raisi has promised to remove what he called the tyrannical sanctions, but will not base his economic policies on reliance on the West, in particular the U.S.
Ibrahim Raisi is now officially the eighth president of the Islamic Republic of Iran after his mandate was endorsed by leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, at a ceremony in Tehran. Ayatollah Khamenei's decree endorsed the presidential mandate of Raisi. The text was read out at the event by head of the leader's office. The ceremony took place at Imam Khomeini Hosseiniyeh in Tehran in full compliance with COVID safety protocols and was attended by the country's senior state and military officials. Raisi said, through their participation in the election, the Iranian people sent a message that they are demanding change, justice, as well as a fight against corruption, poverty, and discrimination. For his part, Ayatollah Khamenei called for a swift formation of the administration and said the country's conditions do not warrant a delay in the process.
The new Iranian president has not outlined his foreign policy in detail, but has promised to solidify and forge stronger ties with his neighbors. And on sanctions, he has made it clear that he would work to remove U.S. sanctions and would not link them to Iranians' livelihoods. Economic challenges will be a top priority for him, as evidenced in his acceptance speech upon being sworn in.
Raisi is the eighth president of the Islamic Republic of Iran. He won almost 62% of the votes in the June 18th presidential election and will succeed President Hassan Rouhani, who served 2 4-year terms in office. Raisi will take an oath of office in an inauguration ceremony at the Iranian parliament, or Majlis, on Thursday. But his new government is set to face a series of challenges. First and foremost, Iran's economy needs urgent action and medium-term planning to grow. Cruel and illegal US sanctions and the COVID-19 pandemic have severely hampered Iran's economic growth. Iran is also dealing with an unprecedented drought, which has negatively affected its energy production and its agriculture sector in certain parts of the country.
So Iran has survived the American sanctions. I think they can continue as long as they use imaginative ways of implementing the exchange of goods and services by different currencies or barter.
Raisi has pledged to prioritize Iran's domestic needs and combat poverty, unemployment, inflation, and corruption. But in order to achieve that end, a certain give and take on regional issues is necessary, and Iran can prosper by playing an even greater stability role commensurate with the country's pivotal position.
Well, in my view, I think President Raisi won't necessarily remove the sanctions, but what he will do is increase Iran's ability to circumvent them. It's possible, for example, to use other currencies than the United States dollar to pay for trading back and forth.
Raisi has vowed not to repeat his predecessor's mistake of putting nearly all the bets on the nuclear deal and the resolution of foreign-imposed sanctions. He said he will decouple his agenda from the nuclear deal, known as the JCPOA, Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. Raisi has called on the U.S. to live up to its nuclear deal obligations.
I think President Raisi is talking more about countries such as Iraq and Syria and Libya and Lebanon and neighboring countries such as Afghanistan and Pakistan. I think that relying on Saudi Arabia and Israel and the Gulf states is a non-starter.
Raisi has said time and again that his government will solidify the relationship between Iran and regional countries. He's described strong ties with Iran's neighbors as important for the economy.
And that is for World News. Bye-bye for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
The limelight.
More than a billion sea creatures across the Pacific Northwest perished in this year's heat wave, and it's just a taste of what's to come. We now present you an article written by Gabrielle Cannon. The piece is titled Baked Barnacles, Scorched Cherries, The Disastrous Impact of Heat Waves on Plants and Animals. The article has been taken from the British newspaper The Guardian. Forecasts foreshadowed the Pacific Northwest devastating heat wave at the end of June. Marine biologist Christopher Harley was alarmed and intrigued. Then came the smell, and his feelings somberly shifted. Christopher Harley said, "It was this putrid smell of decay. Across hundreds of miles of coastline, the extreme heat baked the barnacles, seaweed, and small sea creatures exposed to the elements along the shore. Starfish that failed to crawl to shadier spots were cooked alive. Mussels laid agape along the rocks, the tissue crisped between their shells." Armed with special equipment, Christopher Harley and his team of researchers at the University of British Columbia in Western Canada descended to the beaches to measure the body temperature of the mussels, but it was too late. By the third day of the record-breaking heat wave, they all had died. He said, "We were just walking across carpets of dead mussels on the shore in awe." Initial estimates show that over a billion creatures that live in the shallow waters across the Pacific Northwest perished in the heat that week. Scientists expect the impact will have a trickle-down effect on the ecosystem and the other animals that rely on those that died for food and habitat. Christopher Harley, a marine biologist, added, "I knew the heat would be ecologically impactful, but I wasn't ready for the magnitude of the destruction." He added, "The more places I visited and the more death I saw, the more sobering the whole event became." The unprecedented heat events that scorched the West this summer, smashing dozens of local temperature records across the region, had disastrous effects on people, plants, and animals. Climate scientists say this is just a taste of what's to come. As the environment continues to warm due to human-caused global heating, spiking temperatures will become more frequent, more intense, and last longer. Because heat and drought are inextricably linked, the compounding catastrophes that have plagued the western United States and Canada this summer will persist into the future, continuing to wreak havoc on ecosystems, infrastructure, and agriculture. Scientists are still working to document and understand the impact of the recent heat waves, but the research has been clear that this anomalous event could become the norm over the next 30 years as the planet continues to warm. Andrew Hull, a meteorologist for the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA, Physical Sciences Laboratory, said it's going to continue to get hotter, noting that rising temperatures are unequivocally linked to human activities. He explained, "That means it is going to take much moisture supply in terms of precipitation to stave off drought. That is going to be a game changer in terms of how we live." According to a study led by researchers at the University of Colorado, published earlier this year, extreme heat could increase crop damage tenfold. The real-time effects are already being seen across the West, where farmers and ranchers have struggled to adapt to extremely dry conditions, even before temperatures began to spike. According to the British Columbia Fruit Growers Association, more than half of the cherry crop in Western Canada was damaged in late June. Pinder Dhaliwal, the association's president, told CBC News, "It seems like somebody took a blowtorch to it and just singed it." He added, "Even cherries that looked untouched from the outside were cooked, appearing hot all the way through to the pit." Growers and their respective associations have also reported that raspberries, blueberries, and blackberries were baked across the northern west coast before they could be picked, and stone fruits and apples were damaged and burnt from the high temperatures. Experts from the U.S. Department of Agriculture, USDA, have expressed concern that shriveled wheat berries and diminished kernels will mean a drastic reduction in wheat production this season. Temperatures above 95 degrees Fahrenheit, 35 degrees Celsius, have also been found to change parts of potatoes from starch to sugar and stunt their growth. Meanwhile, a drought-induced shortage of California's thirsty tomatoes used for processing is expected to spike prices for the foods made from them, like pizza sauce and ketchup. As of last month, close to half of the contiguous United States was mired in drought, according to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Association scientists, and more than 15% of the nation experienced record heat for June, the largest number of spiking temperatures ever recorded. Extreme heat and drought, which are individually costly and devastating disasters, go hand in hand, complicating efforts to adapt and recover. The combined conditions also set the stage for fast-burning wildfires that have already torched close to 3 million acres, that is 1.2 million hectares of land, this year. Steve Ostoja, director of the U.S. Department of Agriculture California Climate Hub, said, "You have the gradual shift of climate change working in the background," he added, "but the extreme events are the things that really throw you off." According to Steve Ostoja, the historical record indicates between 4 and 6 extreme heat waves a year. But climate models indicate that on current trajectories, there could be between 25 and 30 of these events by mid-century. He said, "That's a huge difference," adding, "That basically means it is going to be that hot all the time." Water and moisture that could help alleviate strain during the extreme heat is currently in short supply because of the drought. Plants experience higher stress, animals can't keep cool, and shallow waterways warm faster, making habitats inhospitable. Steve Ostoja said, "It is looking like water scarcity is going to be the theme of the future, and we know warming is in our future," noting that there will be a marked shift in how agriculture is approached in places such as California, which currently produces over a third of the country's vegetables and two-thirds of the country's fruits and nuts. Jonathan Stillman, a professor of biology at San Francisco State University, said animals are also struggling to adapt, and for some, the prognosis is grim. His research shows that for animals that have already adjusted to higher heat, it will be even harder to adapt when the temperatures spike further. He said they don't have the ability to cope when the temperature goes just a little bit above the maximum that they're adapted to. He added, "They can't tolerate just a little bit more." This includes small birds living on the edge of their water needs, desert dwellers who have nowhere else to go when the nights fail to cool down, and fish that aren't able to reach the areas they spawn. Spring run Chinook salmon in California's Central Valley were decimated by the heat after making a significant recovery following the 2018 campfire that critically diminished the already threatened fish. More than 83% of the roughly 15,000 adults in Butte Creek, the largest population of the federally protected fish near Chico, California, died, according to Howard Brown, a senior policy advisor with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's Fisheries West Coast region. Calling this an indicator of the severity of the drought and heat wave, he said, "It is devastating. It is the largest loss of adult salmon we have ever seen in the Central Valley of California." Salmon in the Columbia River, further north, were also documented swimming slowly and lethargically through the overheated waters with large red abrasions and burn marks. According to research from Bradfield Lyon, a professor at the Climate Change Institute at the University of Maine, as heat waves become more frequent and more intense, they're also expected to impact physically larger areas at once. Bradfield Lyon said, "By mid-century, the special size of heat waves in the United States are expected to increase between about 50% and 80% from what they are in the current climate." He added, "The frequency will increase, the duration will increase, as well as the intensity. It's alarming, but Bradfield Lyon and each of other researchers hope this episode and the promise of more extreme heat serve as a call for change." The models used to predict the disasters to come are based on current levels of energy consumption and carbon dioxide emission. There are advances being made and the potential for progress abounds. Likening the situation to fire drills used to teach school children about how to respond during emergencies, Bradfield Lyon, a professor of climate change at the University of Maine, said, "The way I look at it is that it is a very stark warning." He said, "The teacher would say, now don't panic, but head as quickly as possible for the exits," adding, "In this case, the exit is burning of fossil fuels. We don't need to panic, but we certainly need to head as quickly as possible in that direction."
First methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
يا أيها الذين آمنوا, O you who believe, استعينوا بالصبر والصلاة.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now we invite you to listen to a speech by Sheikh Hamza Sodagian.
Mushrikeen created trouble for the Prophet. They attacked the Muslimin. They threatened the Muslimin. And so the Prophet had to deal with them militarily. And upon their defeat militarily, they gave in to the rule of the Prophet, so there was military combat. In the incident of the conquest of Mecca, although there wasn't in the end a military conflict, but there were at least three conflicts that preceded it: the Battle of Badr, the Battle of Uhud, the Battle of Ahzab. That was, although it was the Ahzab, numerous tribes, nations, the Jews and the Mushrikeen pretty much came together against the Prophet, but it was something that was spearheaded by, again, the Mushrikeen of Mecca predominantly. They were the staunch enemies of the Prophet in the center of Shirk in Arabia at the time. So although the conquest of Mecca did not involve a military conflict, yet the way it happened was that there were three military conflicts, and also when the Prophet went for the conquest of Mecca, there was a military presence that in the end did not have to engage militarily, but there was a military presence. In the incident of Mubahala, there was no talk of and no involvement of any type of military equipment, any warfare, any army, any warriors, none of that. It was a discussion and a debate that the Christians of Najran came forward, and they were waiting for a prophet, and the prophet claiming that he is the prophet that they're waiting for, and showing the signs, them not being convinced, apparently, some of them. However way those details worked, in the end, there was a call for a mubahala, a session where the two parties come, and they both curse the liar and the one who is on the wrong course. And Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala will show and reveal the truth in that process, where the one who is truthful, the one who is true, will be the one that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala assists, and the other will be wiped out. This is something on its own, the idea of mubahala. There's a few things about this that I don't want to discuss. There's something related to mubahala that we do want to discuss. It's very important. The parts that I don't want to discuss, I'm just going to go over very briefly, is that we have to really, honestly, between us and Allah, بيننا وبين الله, make sure that we are looking at the situation correctly. The reason why we're believing haq to be haq is there. It's based on reason. It's clear. It's there. We didn't make it up. It's not about me. It's not about me having said something that I now cannot retract. And in order to keep my face, I want to push and say, no, this was right, because I don't want to accept that I made a mistake. This is very important. We should be completely willing that if what I said, what I did, what I am doing, the course I am taking is wrong, look into it. If it's wrong, I will change that. I will accept fault. I will accept that I made a mistake. One of the things that we have in Islam is Amr bil Ma'ruf wa Nahi anil Munkar. But beside the verses in a hadith about Amr bil Ma'ruf wa Nahi anil Munkar, is the idea of I'timar bil Ma'ruf. يَتَنَاهَوْنَ عَنِ الْمُنْكَرِ. If they're told this is munkar, they look at it. They don't say, oh no, I'm too good to do anything wrong. They look at it and they see, oh, they're right. This is munkar. I should accept it. That's one thing. That's not what we're discussing. What we're discussing is this situation. If we are on the right path, we are, we're looking at it, we keep looking at it, we listen to what they're saying. They say for this reason, that reason, A, B, C, these are reasons why you're wrong. Like, okay, I'm looking at what you're saying. A is not right for this reason. B is not right for this reason. C, if you have anything else, let me know. But these are not reasons. They're actually, they prove the opposite or whatever it is. It's clear. The course of action Allah has made clear to me. This is the course of action. However, there's a lot of pressure mounting on the opposition. A lot of mouths, a lot of words, a lot of people, a lot of negative attention. That creates a load on one's shoulder. It creates pressure. If we get this lesson from Eidul Mubahala, look for the truth and rest assured, if you're following the truth to the best of your ability to see the truth, rest assured Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is pleased with you. That's enough. It doesn't matter who says what. It doesn't matter. This will give a person the strength to stand even with a few. The Holy Prophet came forward with his household. He put in, there was no real danger actual, because it's clear the Prophet is the Prophet and so on. But with all that pressure for us, that we don't have that level of clarity, the thought may come to us, what if? Look at it. If this is the truth, don't worry. There's no danger. Move forward. Move forward. And Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala will protect. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. All these verses in the Quran, let's give some references besides this story. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says in the Quran, إِنَ اللَّهَ مَعَ الْمُتَّقِينَ. If you're careful to do things based on what He has said, you're a muttaqi. God says, Inna Allah ma'al muttaqi. He's with you. If He is with you, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala will not allow you to go down. Allah will not allow you to be defeated. Allah will not allow you to be harmed. He's protecting you. Allahu waliyu alladhina amanu. Okay. Another very nice verse, it's said to the Prophet, but it's in the Quran. It's addressed to him, for us to hear. It's addressing us in that way indirectly as well. فَإِن تَوَلَّوْا. If everybody turns back, فَقُلْ. Say, حَسْبِيَ اللَّهِ. God is sufficient for me. لَا إِلَهَ إِلَّا هُوَ. There is no Lord but Him. عَلَيْهِ تَوَكَّلْتُ. I rely on Him. وَهُوَ رَبُّ الْعَرْشِ الْعَظِيمِ. He is the Lord of the great throne. He controls everything. I rely on him. I don't care. All of you can turn away. I rely on him. He is sufficient. I'm not looking for the approval of anyone except for him. If God doesn't approve it, I ask him to kill me and not allow me to do it. If he approves it, I don't care if the world disapproves it. This is what the verse says. And rest assured, if you do that, you will be the victor. You will be the one that, in the end, you'll see the results of it. Anyone who relies on Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. We hope that the Ahlul Bayt, the Ahlul Mubahala, the ones who were present in the great event of Mubahala, take our hands. Show all of us, all the Muslimin, Muslimat, Mu'mineen, Mu'minat, lovers and followers of the Ahlul Bayt, the innocent people that have been deceived even of thinking that Islam is wrong, and they don't really hate Islam as it is. They hate the portrayal of Islam that is being given to them by the media, by the wrong sources, which is ugly. What they portray of Islam is horrible, and people shouldn't like that. That's not Islam, however. They disguise Islam with all these ugly terms, ugly attributions to make people hate Islam. People are hating those portrayals. A lot of people, if they would know what Islam actually is, they would love it. If they're good people, any good person, there's plenty out there, they would love it. The problem is what they've been told of Islam. We ask Allah, by the rights of the Ahlul Bayt, to include all of these people, the mu'minun, the muslimun, the innocent that have been deceived in thinking Islam is bad, who are rejecting because of that reason. Otherwise, they're good people. We ask Allah to save all of us, guide all of us, take us from the darkness of the material realm and the attachments of the material realm, and draw us closer to Himself through the Ahlul Bayt, these beacons of guidance that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has given us, inshallah.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karimun Adi Alimun Hali Hakimun Mati. شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمنين صلوا عليه.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Limelight. U.S. media has called for a U.S. military intervention in Haiti following the assassination of President Moi. Minpress News spoke to Haitians to ask them what they think about a possible fourth U.S. military invasion of Haiti since 1915. Please stay with us for an article in this regard written by Dan Cohen, journalist. This article is published under the heading, Haitians Reject Calls for U.S. Military Intervention. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. 2 weeks after the assassination of Haitian President Moi, the specter of U.S. military intervention looms large over the island nation. While the Biden administration has rebuffed the request for intervention made by Claude Joseph, a longtime NED asset whom Washington briefly backed as prime minister in the immediate aftermath of the killing, it has not completely ruled out the possibility. In the days immediately following Moi's grisly machine gun murder on July 7th by U.S.-trained Colombian mercenaries, the Washington Post editorial board published a call for swift and muscular intervention, what would be the fourth U.S. military invasion of Haiti since 1915, when U.S. Marines first occupied the hemisphere's second independent nation. On July 13th, as the Biden administration signaled its reluctance to launch a full-scale invasion of Haiti, the Post editorial board published a second call for U.S. military intervention, suggesting that it was the least bad option. The same day, Post columnist and neoconservative writer Max Boot published an op-ed asserting that Haitians actually desire a U.S. invasion entitled "Sorry, Haiti, the world's policeman is officially off duty." Even the ostensibly progressive lawmaker Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez refused to take a clear position against an intervention, saying that she opposed it right now and without any sort of plan. While the Washington consensus is firmly in support of U.S. military deployment in Haiti, Minpress News traveled to Port-au-Prince to ask random Haitians in the street what they thought of a possible intervention. Adrian Willian told Minpress, "We don't want a military intervention. We are for Haitians putting their heads together. We don't want any foreign intervention to come resolve our problems for us," echoed Ernest C. Denoir. "On the contrary, that would be pouring gas on the fire, making the situation worse," he added. Contrary to the claims of self-appointed spokesman for the Haitian people, Max Boot, and his fellow neoconservative ideologues at the Washington Post, not a single Haitian with whom Minpress News spoke agreed. In fact, many were outraged at the suggestion and hold the United States responsible for the current violence and dysfunction plaguing their country, Haiti, thundered Denoir. "The insecurity you see here is programmed by the oligarchy and the imperialist U.S. Meanwhile, thousands of Haitians turned out on Friday, July 23rd, for Moi's state funeral in Cap Haitien, the capital of Northern Department where he was raised. Many hurled curses at the U.S. delegation, which included U.S. Ambassador to Haiti Michelle Sisson and was headed by U.S. Ambassador to the U.N. Linda Thomas Greenfield, as it approached the funeral stage. The U.S. delegation fled the ceremony before it was over when police fired warning shots and tear gas to repel angry crowds wanting to enter the ceremony or stop it until intellectual authors of assassination are found. Despite its claim to have no plans for now to invade Haiti, the U.S. has appointed a special envoy to Haiti, Daniel Foote, and will begin advising the Haitian National Police, PNH, in anti-gang fighting, the Haiti Liberal reported on July 24th. By those from France and Canada last invaded Haiti immediately following the February 29, 2004 coup d'etat against President Jean-Bertrand Aristide. As was done after their 1994 intervention, they handed the ensuing military occupation of Haiti over to a United Nations peacekeeping force after 3 months. UN forces occupied Haiti for the next 15 years. The troop deployment violated Chapter 7 of the UN Charter, which specifies that the Security Council can use force only to maintain or restore international peace and security, that is, in a conflict between two states, not to meddle in an internal political conflict. The Haitian Constitution also forbids foreign troops on Haitian soil. The 2004 intervention began on February 28 when a SEAL team led by U.S. Charge d'Affaires Luis Moreno surrounded Aristide's home, then threatened and browbeat the president into boarding an unmarked jet, which whisked him away to Africa. Aristide later called the abduction a modern kidnapping. We remember that the U.S. came and took our charismatic leader, Jean-Bertrand Aristide, in 2004, recalled William. That coup d'etat is the cause of the state we are in today, he added. The U.S. betrayed the Haitian people when it kidnapped Aristide, William concluded. The bitter taste of past military interventions and occupations informs the almost universal Haitian public opinion against another U.S. incursion. You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common. Imam Khomeini guided the Iranian nation to determine their own fate. June 4, 2021. The televised speech delivered on June 4, 2021 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the 32nd demise anniversary of Imam Khomeini. Greetings be upon him. You should not be a slave to others because God has made you free. You should choose on your own. You are free to choose your fate. This is one of the obvious points in Islam. Therefore, the people's authority and democracy is reliant on these religious teachings. The Quran, Hadith, Nahjul Balagha, and the Holy Prophets and the Commander of the Faithful's behavior reflect these teachings in the Siffin Sermon, Sermon number 216. The Commander of the Faithful says, "Therefore, do not abstain from saying a truth or pointing out a matter of justice." It basically says, do not avoid giving me counsel and express your opinion about my ways and methods. This is how it is. So the people's responsibility and rights are based on Islam. This was the first perspective. Government's need for popular support. The second perspective of the discussion about the Republican aspect of the Islamic Republic is about support and the need for popular support. This is also an obvious point. If governments, not just religious governments, rather all governments, are deprived of popular support, and if the people do not advocate them, they will have to live a life of wielding swords and cracking whips. In other words, it will not be possible to sustain the government. Of course, an Islamic and Quranic government is not after oppressing the people, wielding its sword and whipping the people. Therefore, it cannot live without the people's support. It was neither possible to create the Islamic Republic without popular support, nor was it possible after its formation to sustain the government without such support. Thankfully, the system has continued to exist and it will continue to exist from now on too.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.